He made an effort and addressed Golenishev.
"I think I had the pleasure of meeting you," he said, glancing uneasily now at Anna and now at Vronsky, in order not to lose any detail of their expressions. "Of course, we first met at Rossi's. Don't you remember that evening when the Italian lady recited? The new Rachel?" began Golenishev, glibly, turning away from the picture to the artist without the slightest regret. Noticing, however, that Mikhailov was waiting to hear his criticism of the picture, he said, "Your picture has progressed very much since I last saw it, and now, as then, I am specially struck by the figure of Pilate. One can so well understand that man, a kind, first-rate fellow, but an official to his very backbone, who does not know what he is doing. But it seems to me..."
The whole of Mikhailov's mobile face suddenly lighted up. His eyes brightened. He wanted to speak, but was too agitated and pretended to cough instead. Little as he valued Golenishev's capacity to understand art, unimportant as was his remark about the truth of Pilate's official expression, while what was important remained unmentioned, and offensive as was this trivial, it might have seemed to him, remark before anything had been said about what was most important, Mikhailov was delighted with it. His opinion of that figure was the same. The fact that this opinion was but one of a million of other opinions, which, as Mikhailov well knew, would all have been just, did not for him detract from the importance of Golenishev's remark. He took a liking to Golenishev because of that remark, and his depression changed suddenly into delight. In an instant, his whole picture became alive before his eyes, with the inexpressible complexity of everything that lives. He wished to say that it was just so that he understood Pilate, but his trembling lips would not obey him, and he was unable to speak. Vronsky and Anna were talking in the hushed voice in which, partly not to offend the artist, and partly not to utter aloud a stupid remark such as is so easily made when speaking about art, people generally talk at picture exhibitions. Mikhailov thought that on them, too, the picture had created an impression, and went up to them.
"How wonderful Christ's expression is," said Anna.
That expression pleased her more than all else she saw, and she felt that it was the centre of the picture, and that therefore praise of it would be agreeable to the artist.
"One sees he is sorry for Pilate."
This, too, was one of a million just remarks which might have been made with reference to his picture and the figure of Christ. She said he was sorry for Pilate. In Christ's expression there should be pity, because there was love in it, a peace not of this world, a readiness for death, and a knowledge of the vanity of words. Of course there was an official expression in Pilate's face, and pity in Christ's, for the former was the embodiment of carnal and the latter of spiritual life. All this and much more floated through Mikhailov's mind, and again his face shone with ecstasy.
"Yes, and how well that figure is done, and what an atmosphere there is! One could walk round it," said Golenishev, showing evidently by this remark that he did not approve of the content and idea of the figure.
"Yes, it is wonderfully masterly. How those figures in the background stand out!"
"That is technique," said Vronsky, addressing Golenishev,
and alluding to a conversation they had had about Vronsky's despair of attaining technical mastery.
"Yes, yes, wonderful,"
chimed in Golenishev and Anna. In spite of his elation, this remark about technique grated painfully on Mikhailov's heart, and glancing angrily at Vronsky, he suddenly frowned. He often heard the word technique mentioned, and did not at all understand what was meant by it. He knew it meant a mechanical capacity to paint and draw, quite independent of the subject matter. He had often noticed, as now when his picture was being praised, that technique was contrasted with inner quality, as if it were possible to paint well something that was bad. He knew that much attention and care were needed not to injure one's work when removing the wrappings that obscure the idea, and that all wrappings must be removed. But as to the art of painting, the technique,
It did not exist.
If the things he saw had been revealed to a little child, or to his cook, they would have been able to remove the outer shell from their idea. And the most experienced and technical painter could never paint anything by means of mechanical skill alone, if the outline of the subject matter did not first reveal itself to his mind. Moreover, he saw that if technique was spoken of, then he could not be praised for it. In all he painted and ever had painted, he saw defects that were an eyesore to him, the results of carelessness in removing the shell of the idea, which he could not now remedy without spoiling the work as a whole. And in almost all the figures and faces he saw traces of wrappings that had not been entirely removed and that spoilt the picture.
"One thing might be said, if you will allow me to make the remark," began Golenishev.
"Oh, I shall be very pleased. Pray do,"
said Mikhailov with a feigned smile. "It is that you have made him a man-god and not a god-man. However, I know that you wish to do so."
"I could not paint a Christ whom I had not in my soul," Mikhailov rejoined gloomily.
"Yes, but in that case, if I may say what I think, your picture is so good that a remark of mine cannot do it any harm, besides which it's only my personal opinion. Yours is different. The idea itself is different. But let us take Ivanov, for example. I consider that if Christ is to be brought down to the level of an historic figure, it would be better to choose another historic theme, a fresh one, as yet untouched."
"But if this is the highest theme open to art?"
"Well, other themes can be found, if one looks for them. But the fact is, art won't stand discussion and argument, yet Ivanov's picture suggests both to a believer and an unbeliever the question, is this a god or not a god? And the unity of impression is destroyed."
"Why so? To me it seems that for educated people such questions can no longer exist," said Mikhailov.
Golenishev did not agree with this. And keeping to his first contention that unity of impression is indispensable in art, he confuted Mikhailov. The artist was perturbed, but could find nothing to say in defense of his opinion.
Chapter 12. Anna and Vronsky had long been exchanging glances, regretting their friend's clever loquacity. And at last Vronsky, without waiting for his host, crossed the room to look at another and smaller picture.
"Oh, how charming! How charming! Wonderful! Charming!" he and Anna began both at once. "What is it they like so much?" wondered Mikhailov.
He had forgotten all about that picture, painted 3 years before. He had forgotten all the sufferings and raptures he had gone through on account of that work, when it alone had occupied him unremittingly day and night for 3 months. He had forgotten it as he forgot all his finished pictures. He did not even like looking at it, and had only brought it out because he was expecting an Englishman who wished to buy it.
"Oh, that's nothing, only an old study," he said.
"How good,"
remarked Golenishev, evidently sincerely impressed by the charm of the picture. It represented two boys angling in the shade of a willow. The elder had just thrown the line, and, quite absorbed in his occupation, was carefully drawing the float from behind a bush. The younger one lay in the grass, leaning on his elbows with his fair, tousled head in his hands, and with dreamy blue eyes gazing at the water. What was he thinking about? Their delight in his picture aroused in Mikhailov his former excitement, but he feared and disliked their idle interest in his past work, and therefore, though their praises gave him pleasure, he tried to draw his visitor's attention to a third picture. But Vronsky inquired whether this picture was for sale. To Mikhailov, in his excitement over their visit, this mention of money matters was very disagreeable.
"It is put out for sale," he replied, frowning darkly.
When the visitors had left, Mikhailov sat down before his picture of Pilate and Christ and mentally reviewed all that had been said, and even what was not said but only hinted by the visitors. Strange to say, what had had weight with him while they were there, and he looked at things from their point of view, suddenly lost all significance now. He looked at his picture with his artistic perception fully alert, and reached that assurance of the perfection and consequent importance of his picture which he needed to attain the intensity of effort, excluding all other interests, without which he could not work. The foreshortening of Christ's foot was, however, not right. He took his palette and commenced working. While correcting the foot, he kept glancing at the figure of John in the background, which the visitors had not even remarked, but which he knew to be the height of perfection. When he had completed the foot, he was about to do something to that figure, but felt that he was too agitated. He could work neither when he was too indifferent, nor when he was too highly roused and saw everything too distinctly. There was only one stage between calmness and inspiration at which work was possible, and today he was too excited. He was about to cover his picture, but paused, and holding up the sheet, stood a long time with a rapturous smile, gazing at the figure of John. At length, tearing himself away from it regretfully, he let the sheet fall over the picture, and went home, tired but happy. Vronsky, Anna, and Golenishev were particularly animated and high-spirited on their way back. They talked about Mikhailov and his pictures. The word talent, which they understood to mean an innate and almost physical capacity independent of mind and heart, and which was their term for everything an artist lives through, occurred very often in their conversation, since they required it as a name for something which they did not at all understand, but about which they wanted to talk. They said that it was impossible to deny his talent, but that his talent could not develop because of his lack of education, the common misfortune of our Russian artists. But the picture of the boys had gripped their memories, and they kept coming back to it. How charming! How well he has hit it off, and how simply! He does not even understand how good it is. Yes, we must not miss the opportunity of purchasing it, Vronsky declared. Chapter 13. Mikhailov sold Vronsky the picture and consented to paint Anna's portrait. On the appointed day, he came and began working. After the fifth sitting, the portrait struck everyone not only by its likeness, but also by its beauty. It was strange that Mikhailov had been able to discover that special beauty. One needed to know and love her as I love her to find just that sweetest spiritual expression of hers, thought Vronsky, though he himself had only learnt to know that sweetest spiritual expression through the portrait. But the expression was so true that it seemed both to him and to others that they had always known it. How long have I been struggling without accomplishing anything, he said, referring to the portrait he was painting, and he just looked and painted this? That is where technique comes in. That will come in good time, said Golenishev consolingly. Vronsky had talent, and especially the education that gives a lofty outlook on art. Golenishev's conviction that Vronsky possessed talent was supported by the fact that he required Vronsky's sympathy and praise for his articles and ideas, and felt that praise and encouragement should be mutual. In another man's house, and particularly in Vronsky's palazzo, Mikhailov was quite a different man from what he was in his studio. He was unpleasantly deferential, as if fearful of intimacy with persons whom he did not respect. He addressed Vronsky as Your Excellency, and never stayed to dinner, though Anna and Vronsky both invited him, and he never came except for a sitting. Anna was even kinder to him than to others, and was grateful for her portrait. Vronsky was more than polite to him, and was evidently interested in the artist's opinion of his, Vronsky's, picture. Golenishev never missed an opportunity to instill into Mikhailov a true understanding of art. But the latter remained equally cold toward them all. Anna felt by his look that he liked looking at her, but he avoided conversation with her. When Vronsky talked about his art, Mikhailov remained stubbornly silent, and as stubbornly silent when they showed him Vronsky's picture.
and he was evidently oppressed by Golenishev's discourses, to which he made no rejoinder. Altogether, his reserved, disagreeable, and apparently hostile attitude when they came to know him better much displeased them, and they were glad when the sittings were over, the beautiful portrait was theirs, and his visits ceased. Golenishev was the first to express the thought that was in all their minds, namely that Mikhailov was simply jealous of Vronsky. "We won't say jealous, because he has talent, but he is vexed that a man of the court, a rich man, and a count into the bargain, men like him hate all that, should, without any particular difficulty, do as well or even better than he who has devoted his whole life to the work. Especially, there is the education which he lacks." Vronsky took Mikhailov's part, but in the depth of his heart he believed what Golenishev said, for he considered that a man of that other and lower world must envy him. Anna's portrait, the same subject painted from nature by both of them, should have shown him the difference between Mikhailov and himself, but Vronsky did not see it. He merely left off painting Anna, deciding that it would be superfluous now. He went on, however, with his medieval picture, and he, as well as Golenishev, and especially Anna, thought it very good because it resembled famous pictures much more than Mikhailov's did. Meanwhile, Mikhailov, though Anna's portrait had much engrossed him, was even better pleased than they when the sittings were over, and he was no longer obliged to listen to Golenishev's disquisitions on art and was able to forget Vronsky's paintings. He knew it was not possible to forbid Vronsky to trifle with art, knew that he and all the dilettanti had a perfect right to paint what they liked, but to him it was unpleasant. One cannot forbid a man's making a big wax doll and kissing it. But if the man came and sat down with his doll in front of a lover and began to caress it as the lover caresses his beloved, it would displease the lover. It was this kind of unpleasantness that Mikhailov experienced when he saw Vronsky's pictures. He was amused, vexed, sorry, and hurt. Vronsky's interest in art and the Middle Ages did not last long. He had sufficient taste for art to be unable to finish his picture. He ceased painting it because he was dimly conscious that its defects, little noticeable at first, would become striking if he went on. The same thing happened to him as to Golenishev, who, feeling that he had nothing to express, continually deceived himself by saying that his thought had not yet ripened and that he was bringing it to maturity and preparing materials. But Golenishev was embittered and tormented by it, while Vronsky could not deceive and torment himself, and above all could not become embittered. With characteristic firmness he left off painting without any explanations or excuses. But without that occupation, his life and Anna's, who was surprised at his disenchantment, appeared very dull in the Italian town. All of a sudden the palazzo became so obviously old and dirty, so disagreeably familiar with the stains on the curtains, the cracks in the floor, the cracked stuccos of the cornices, and so wearisome became Golenishev, the Italian professor, and the German traveller, who were also always the same, that a change was necessary. So they decided to return to Russia and live in the country. In Petersburg, Vronsky planned to separate his property from his brother's, and Anna to see her son. The summer they intended to spend on Vronsky's large family estate. Chapter 14. Lievin had been married 3 months. He was happy, but in quite a different way from what he had expected. At every step he met disillusionments in his old fancies and new and unexpected enchantments. He was happy, but having embarked on family life, he saw at every step that it was not at all what he had anticipated. At every step he took, he felt as a man would feel who, after admiring the smooth, happy motion of a little boat upon the water, had himself got into the boat. He found that besides sitting quietly without rocking, he had to keep a lookout, not for a moment forget where he was going, or that there was water under his feet, and that he had to row, although it hurt his unaccustomed hands. In short, that it only looked easy,
but to do it, though very delightful, was very difficult. As a bachelor, seeing the married life of others, their petty cares, their disputes, their jealousies, he used mentally to smile contemptuously. In his future married life, he was sure he would have nothing of this kind, and even the external forms of his married life would be quite unlike other people's. And now, behold, his life with his wife had not shaped itself differently, but was all made up of those petty trifles which he had formerly so despised, but which now, against his will, assumed an unusual and incontestable importance. Levin saw that the arrangement of all those trifles was not at all so easy as he had formerly supposed. Though he had imagined his ideas about family life to be most exact, he, like all men, had involuntarily pictured it to himself as merely the enjoyment of love, which nothing should be allowed to hinder, and from which one should not be distracted by petty cares. He should, he thought, do his work and rest from it in the joys of love. She should be loved, and that was all. But, like all men, he forgot that she too must work, and was surprised how she, the poetic, charming Kitty, could, during the very first weeks and even in the first days of married life, think, remember, and fuss about tablecloths, furniture, spare room mattresses, a tray, the cook, the dinner, and so forth. During their engagement, he had been struck by the definiteness with which she declined a trip abroad and decided to go to the country, as if she knew of something that was necessary and could think of something besides their love. He had been pained by it then, and now was repeatedly pained by her petty cares. But he saw that this was necessary to her, and, loving her, though he could not understand what it was all about and laughed at her worries, he could not help admiring them. He laughed at the way she placed the furniture that had been brought from Moscow and rearranged his and her own rooms, hung up curtains, decided about rooms for future visitors and for Dolly, arranged the room for her new maid, gave orders about dinner to the old cook, and entered into discussions with Agafya Mikhailovna, taking the commissariat into her own hands. He saw the old cook smile admiringly and listen to her inexperienced and impossible orders. Saw that Agafya Mikhailovna shook her head thoughtfully and kindly at her young mistress's arrangements in the storeroom. Saw that Kitty was peculiarly charming when she came, half laughing and half crying, to report that her maid, Masha, was used to considering her merely as a young lady in her mother's house, and that therefore no one would obey her. It struck him as very charming, but strange. And he thought it would have been better without all that. He did not realize the feeling of change that she was experiencing after her life at home. There she had sometimes wished for cabbage with kvass or sweets and could not have them, but now she might order whatever she pleased, and could, if she liked, buy heaps of sweets, spend any amount of money, and order all the puddings she pleased. She looked forward joyfully to Dolly's coming with the children, especially because she meant to give each of them their favourite puddings, and because Dolly would appreciate her new arrangements. Without herself knowing why or wherefore, the management of the house attracted her irresistibly. Instinctively feeling the approach of spring and knowing that there would be wet weather, she built her nest as she could, hastening to build it while yet learning how to do it. Kitty's absorption in these trifles, quite contrary to Levin's early ideal of lofty happiness, was one of his disappointments. Yet that sweet absorption, the meaning of which he could not understand but which he could not help liking, was also one of his new enchantments. Another disenchantment and new enchantment was afforded by their quarrels. Levin had never thought it possible that between him and his wife there could ever be any but tender, respectful, and loving relations, and yet from the very beginning they had quarrelled. She had said he did not love her, but only loved himself, and began to cry and wave her arms. This first quarrel arose because Levin had ridden over to see his new farm, and returned half an hour late, having attempted a short cut home and lost his way. He rode home thinking only of her, of her love and of his happiness,
and the nearer he came, the warmer grew his tenderness for her. He ran into the room with the same feelings as, and even stronger ones than, those with which he had gone to the Shcherbatskys' house to propose, and to his astonishment was met with such a dismal look as he had never seen on her face before. He tried to kiss her, but she pushed him away.
"What's the matter?"
"You seem merry," she began, wishing to say something calmly stinging. But directly she opened her mouth, words of reproach, senseless jealousy, and everything else that had been torturing her during the half-hour she had sat motionless, waiting at the window, burst from her. Then it was that he first clearly understood what he did not realize when leading her out of church after the wedding, that she was not only very close to him, but that he could not now tell where she ended and he began. He understood this by a tormenting sensation of cleavage which he experienced at that moment. For an instant he was offended, but immediately knew he could not be offended with her because she was himself. For a moment he felt like a man who, receiving a blow from behind, angrily and revengefully turns round to find his assailant and realizes that he has accidentally knocked himself, that there is no one to be angry with, and that he must endure and try to still the pain. Never again did he feel this so strongly as this first time, and for a long time he could not recover his balance. His natural feelings prompted him to justify himself and prove that she was in the wrong, but to prove her in the wrong would mean irritating her still more and widening the breach which was the cause of all the trouble. One impulse, an habitual one, drew him to shift the blame from himself and lay it upon her, but another, and more powerful one, drew him to smooth over the breach as quickly as possible and not allow it to widen. To remain under so unjust an accusation was painful, but to justify himself and hurt her would be still worse. Like a man half asleep and oppressed with pain, he wanted to tear off the aching part and cast it from him, but found on waking that the aching part was himself. All he could do was to try to soothe the ache and endure it. And this he did. They made it up. Having realized that she was in the wrong, though she did not acknowledge it, she became more tender to him, and they enjoyed a new and doubled happiness in their love. But this did not prevent such collisions recurring quite frequently, and on very unexpected and trivial provocation. These collisions were often caused by each not realizing what was important to the other, and also by the fact that in those early days they were often in low spirits. When one of them was in good spirits and the other was not, peace was not broken. But if both chanced to be out of sorts, collisions resulted from causes so trifling as to be incomprehensible. Often afterwards they could not remember what they had quarrelled about. However, when both were in good spirits, their happiness was doubled. And yet the early days of their married life were very trying. All that time they were conscious of peculiar strain, as if the chain that bound them were being pulled first one way and then the other. Altogether the honeymoon, the first month of their marriage from which Levin had expected so much, was not delightful, but remained in both their recollections as the most oppressive and humiliating time of their lives. They both tried in afterlife to efface from their memories all the ugly, shameful circumstances of this unhealthy time, during which they were rarely in a normal state, and rarely themselves. Only in the third month of their married life, after returning from Moscow, where they had spent a month, did their life begin to run more smoothly. Chapter 15. They had just returned from Moscow and were glad of the solitude. He was in his study and sat at the table, writing. She, in the dark lilac dress she had worn during the first days of her marriage and which was especially memorable and dear to him, sat with her embroidery on that same old leather-covered sofa which had stood in the study through his father's and grandfather's times. As he sat thinking and writing, he was all the while blissfully conscious of her presence. He had not abandoned his work on the estate, or on the book in which the foundations of a new farming system were to be explained,
But as those thoughts and that work formerly appeared to him trivial and insignificant in comparison with the gloom that overshadowed all existence, so now they appeared trivial and insignificant in comparison with his future prospects, all bathed in the bright sunshine of happiness. He went on with his work with a feeling that the center of gravity of his attention had shifted, and that he consequently saw the matter differently and with greater clearness. Formerly this work had been his salvation from life. He used to feel that without it life would be too dismal, and now he needed it in order that his life should not be too monotonously bright. Having set to work again on his manuscript and read over what he had written, he was glad to find that the work seemed worth doing. Many of his former thoughts now appeared superfluous and extreme, but many omissions became clear to him when he went over the matter afresh. He was writing a fresh chapter on why agriculture was not profitable in Russia. He argued that Russia's poverty was caused not only by a wrong distribution of landed property and a false policy, but that of late years those evils had been fostered by a foreign civilization artificially grafted upon Russia, especially as to ways of communication, viz. The railways, which had conduced to a centralization in the cities, a growth of luxury, and consequently to a development of factories at the expense of agriculture, and attendant upon this, to credit operations and speculation. It seemed to him that when the growth of a nation's wealth is normal, these things follow only after a considerable amount of labor has been devoted to agriculture, and after the latter has been placed in its rightful, or at any rate in a definite, position. That a nation's wealth ought to grow proportionately at the same rate in all its branches, and especially in such a way that the other branches should not outdistance agriculture. That means of communication should conform to the agricultural conditions, and that with our wrong methods of using the land, the railways, brought about not by economic but by political necessity, had come prematurely, and instead of promoting agriculture, as had been expected, had interfered with it, and hindered it by stimulating the development of manufactures and credit. Therefore, as the one-sided and premature development of a single organ in an animal would injure its general development, so credit, railways, and the forced growth of manufacturers, though undoubtedly necessary in Europe, where the time was ripe for them, had in Russia only harmed the general development of wealth by thrusting aside the most important current question, namely, the organization of agriculture. While he was writing his thoughts, she was thinking about his unnatural attention to young Prince Tcharsky, who had been very tactlessly paying court to her on the day before their departure from Moscow. "Why, he's jealous," she thought. "Oh, dear, how sweet and silly he is. Jealous of me. If he only knew that all the rest of them are no more than Pyotr the cook to me." And she glanced with a feeling of proprietorship, strange to herself, at the nape of his red neck. "Though it's a pity to interrupt him at his work, but he'll have time enough. I must see his face. Will he feel that I am looking at him? I want him to turn. I want it." "Well?" And she opened her eyes wider, trying thereby to increase the force of her look. "Yes, they divert all the sap. They produce a false glamour," he muttered, pausing, and feeling that she was looking at him, he turned round, smiling. "Well?" he asked with a smile, and rose. "He has turned," she thought. "Nothing, I only wanted to make you turn round," said she, gazing at him and trying to discover whether he was vexed at the interruption. "I say, how delightful it is for us to be alone together. For me, I mean," he said, coming toward her with a beaming smile of happiness. "It is delightful for me, too. I shan't go anywhere, especially not to Moscow."
"And what were you thinking about?"
I was thinking..." "No, no, go and write. Don't let me distract you," she said, puckering her lips. "And I must cut out these little holes, you see."
Taking up her scissors, she began cutting.
"Come, tell me what it was," he said,
sitting down beside her and watching the circular movement of her tiny scissors.
"Oh, what was I thinking about?" "About
Moscow, and about the nape of your neck?
Why should such happiness come just to me? It's not natural. It is too beautiful, he said, kissing her hand.
To me, the more beautiful it is, the more natural it seems. Your hair comes to a point behind, he said, carefully turning her head round. A point? Yes, so it does. There. But enough. We are engaged on serious matters.
But their serious matters did not get on, and they jumped apart guiltily when Kutzma came to say that tea was served. And have they returned from town? Levin inquired of Kutzma. They've just come and are unpacking.
Be quick and come, she said as she left the study, or else I shall read all the letters without you. And after that, let's have a duet.
Left alone, having put away his papers in the new portfolio she had bought, he washed his hands at the new washstand with the new and elegant utensils that had also appeared through her agency. He smiled at his thought and shook his head disapprovingly at it. A feeling resembling repentance tormented him. There was something contemptible, effeminate, Capuan, as he called it, in his present life. It is not right to live so, he thought. Soon it will be 3 months since I did anything worth mentioning. This is almost the first day that I have really set to work seriously. And what has come of it? Scarcely had I begun when I stopped. Even my usual duties all almost abandoned. The farm work? Why, I hardly even go and see about that. Sometimes I am sorry to part from her. Sometimes I can see she is dull. And I used to think that up to the time of my marriage life would go on just so-so, anyhow, and not count for much, but that after marriage real life was going to begin. And now that is nearly 3 months ago, and I have never spent my days more idly or uselessly. No, this can't go on. I must make a beginning. Of course it is not her fault. There is nothing to reproach her with. I ought to have been firmer and upheld my independence as a man. This way I shall get into bad habits and teach them to her, too. Of course it is not her fault, he said to himself. But it is difficult for a dissatisfied man not to reproach someone else, namely the person most closely connected with the subject of his dissatisfaction. And Levin dimly felt that though she was not herself in fault, she never could be in fault, it was the fault of her bringing up which was too superficial and frivolous. That fool, Tcharsky. I knew she wanted to stop him, but did not know how, he thought. Yes, except for the interest she takes in the housekeeping, that interest she certainly has, her clothes and her embroidery. She has no real interests. She takes no interest in our work, in the farm, in the peasants, or in music, though she is quite good at that, or in books. She does nothing and is quite content. In his heart he blamed her, but he did not understand that she was preparing herself for a period of activity which was inevitably coming, when at one and the same time she would be her husband's wife, the mistress of the house, and a bearer, nurturer, and educator of her children. He did not understand that, but she knew it instinctively. And while getting ready for her gigantic task, she did not reproach herself for the moments of careless and happy love that she now enjoyed while building her nest for the future.
Chapter 16. When Levin came upstairs, his wife was sitting beside the new silver samovar with a new tea service before her, reading a letter from Dolly, with whom she kept up a regular and active correspondence. She had made old Agafya Mikhailovna sit at a little table with a cup of tea she had poured out for her.
You see, your lady has made me sit with her, said Agafya Mikhailovna, glancing with a friendly smile at Kitty.
In these words of Agafya Mikhailovna's, Levin read the conclusion of the drama which had lately been enacted between Agafya Mikhailovna and Kitty. He perceived that despite Agafya Mikhailovna's grief at the advent of the new mistress who had taken the reins of management into her own hands, Kitty had conquered and had made the old woman love her. "There, I've read your letter," said Kitty, handing him a badly written letter. "It is from that woman, I think. Your brother's... No, I have not read it. These are from home, and from Dolly. Fancy, Dolly took Grisha and Tanya to a children's party at the Sarmatskys. Tanya went as a marquise." But Levin did not listen. He blushed as he took Maria Nikolaevna's letter. This was the second letter he had received from the woman who had been his brother's mistress. In the first, she wrote that his brother had sent her away for no fault of hers, adding, with touching naivete, that though she was again in want, she did not ask or desire anything, but wrote because she was crushed by the thought that Nikolai Dmitrich would perish without her, his health being so bad. She begged Levin to keep watch over his brother. This time she wrote differently. She had found Nikolai Dmitrich, had joined him in Moscow, and had gone with him to a provincial town where he had obtained a post in the civil service. But he had quarrelled with his chief, and they had started again for Moscow, when he fell so ill on the way that it was hardly likely he would ever get up again. She wrote, "He keeps on thinking of you. Besides, there is no money left." "Read it. Dolly writes about you," Kitty began with a smile, but paused suddenly, noticing the changed expression on her husband's face. "What's the matter? What is it?"
"She writes that my brother Nikolai is on his deathbed. I'm going."
Kitty's look changed at once. Thoughts of Tanya as a marquise and of Dolly had quite vanished. "When are you going?" she asked.
"Tomorrow." "I shall go too, may I?"
"Kitty, what do you mean?" he said reproachfully. "What indeed?" she replied, offended that he seemed opposed to and vexed at her offer. "Why should I not go? I shan't be in your way. I
am going because my brother is dying," said Levin. "But why should you?"
"Why? For the same reason as you. At such an important time, she thinks only of how dull it will be for her alone here," he thought. And this motive, in connection with something so important, vexed him.
"It is impossible," he replied sternly.
Agafya Mikhailovna, seeing that a quarrel was imminent, softly put down her cup and went out. Kitty did not even notice her. The tone in which her husband had said these words hurt her, especially as he evidently disbelieved what she had said. "And I say that if you go, I shall go with you. I will certainly go," she said hastily and angrily. "Why is it impossible? Why do you say it is impossible?"
"Because it means going goodness knows where, and by what roads, to what inns." "You would be in my way," said Levin, endeavouring to keep cool.
"Not at all. I shan't want anything, and where you can go, I can."
"Well, if only because that woman is there with whom you cannot associate."
"I don't know and don't want to know anything about who and what is there. I know that my husband's brother is dying, that my husband is going to him, and that I am going with my husband in order—"
"Kitty, don't be angry. But just think, this matter is so important. It hurts me to think that you are mixing up with it your weakness, your dislike of remaining alone. Well, if you feel dull alone, well, go to Moscow.
There, you see,
you always attribute bad and vile motives to me," she began with tears of anger and resentment. "I am all right, not weak, nor anything. I feel that it's my duty to be with my husband when he is in trouble, but you wish to hurt me on purpose. You purposely don't want to understand me. No, this is awful, being a sort of slave," exclaimed Levin, unable to restrain his annoyance any longer, but immediately conscious that he had dealt a blow to himself. "Then why did you marry?
You might have been free. Why, since you are repenting? She said, and jumped up and ran into the drawing-room.
When he came in after her, she was sobbing. He began speaking, trying to find words not so much to dissuade as to pacify her. But she did not listen and did not agree to anything he said. He stooped and took her resisting hand. He kissed her hand, her hair, and again her hand, but she remained silent. But when he took her face in his hands and said, "Kitty," she suddenly recovered, cried a little, and then they made it up. It was settled that they would start together the next day. Levin told his wife he believed she only wanted to go that she might be of use, and agreed that Maria Nikolaevna's presence at his brother's would not make it at all improper. But he was going, dissatisfied in the depths of his heart with both himself and her. He was dissatisfied with her because she could not face letting him go when it was necessary, and how strange it was to think that he, who such a short time ago dared not believe in the happiness of her loving him, now felt unhappy because she loved him too much, and dissatisfied with himself because he had not maintained his authority. Still less could he with conviction agree that the woman who was with his brother did not matter, and he thought with terror of all the encounters that might take place. The single fact that his wife, his Kitty, would be in the same room with a girl off the streets made him shudder with repulsion and horror. Chapter 17. The hotel in the provincial town where Nikolai Levin was lying ill was one of those provincial hotels arranged after new and improved models, with the best intentions of cleanliness, comfort, and even elegance, but which, owing to the people who use them, very soon degenerate into mere dirty pothouses with pretensions to modern improvements, these very pretensions making them worse than the old-fashioned inns, which were simply dirty. This hotel had already reached this stage. Everything, the soldier in a dirty uniform smoking a cigarette at the front door, acting as a hall porter, the dismal and unpleasant ornamental cast-iron staircase, the free-and-easy waiter in a dirty dress coat, the general room with a dusty bouquet of wax flowers decorating the table, the dust and slovenliness everywhere mingled with a kind of modern, self-satisfied railway-induced state of bustle. All this caused a feeling of depression in the Levins after their fresh home life, especially as the air of artificiality about this hotel was quite irreconcilable with what was awaiting them. As usual, after the inquiry as to what priced rooms they desired, it turned out that there was not a single good room vacant. One good room was occupied by a railway inspector, another by a lawyer from Moscow, a third by the Princess Astafieva from the country. There was just one dirty room to be had, but they were promised that an adjoining one would be free by the evening. Vexed with his wife because his expectations were being realized, namely that, at the moment of arrival, when his heart was seized with agitation at the thought of his brother's condition, he was obliged to consider her instead of running to him at once, Levin led her to the room. "Go, go," she said with a timid, guilty look at him. He went out silently, and at the very door came upon Maria Nikolaevna, who had heard of his arrival but had not dared to enter. She was just the same as he had seen her in Moscow, the same stuff dress without collar or cuffs, and the same kindly, dull, pockmarked face, only somewhat stouter.
"Well, how is he? What is it?"
"Very bad. Does not get up. He was expecting you all the time. He...
You are with your wife?"
For a moment he did not understand the cause of her confusion, but she immediately explained it.
"I will go. I will go to the kitchen," she brought out. "He will be pleased. He heard, and he knows and remembers her abroad."
Levin understood that she referred to his wife, and did not know what to say.
"Come along. Come," he said.
But he had hardly moved when the door opened and Kitty looked out.
Lievin blushed with shame and vexation at his wife for having placed herself and him in this awkward position. But Maria Nikolaevna blushed still more. She shrank together, flushed till tears filled her eyes, and seizing the ends of her shawl began twisting them in her red fingers, not knowing what to say or do. At the first glance, Lievin saw an expression of eager curiosity in the look with which Kitty gazed at this incomprehensible and terrible woman, but it lasted only an instant.
"Well, how is he? How is he?" she said, addressing first her husband and then the woman.
"Dear me, we can't talk in the corridor," said Lievin, looking crossly at a man who was just passing along with jerky steps, ostensibly on business of his own.
"Well then, come in," said Kitty to Maria Nikolaevna, who had regained her self-control.
"Or better still, you go on and send for me," she continued, noticing her husband's frightened look, and then returned to their room. Lievin went to his brother. He had not expected what he saw and felt when he reached his brother's side. He had expected to find him in that state of self-deception which, he had heard, was frequent in consumptive cases, and which had so struck him at the time of his brother's visit to him in the autumn. He had expected to find the physical signs of approaching death more definite. Greater weakness, greater emaciation, but still the same sort of condition generally. He had expected to feel the same sorrow at the loss of a loved brother, and the same horror of death he had then experienced, but to a greater degree, and had prepared himself for all this. But what he found was quite different. In the dirty little room with a painted dado spotted with spittle, behind the thin partition wall of which could be heard the sound of voices, in stuffy, smelly, foul air, on a bed drawn away from the wall, lay a body covered with a blanket. One arm of that body lay outside the blanket, and the enormous hand, like a rake, seemed to be attached in some incomprehensible way to a long, thin spindle that was quite straight from the end to the middle. The head lay on its side on the pillow. Lievin could see the moist, thin hair on the temples and the drawn, transparent-looking forehead.
"Impossible that this terrible body can be my brother Nikolai," he thought. But he drew nearer, saw the face, and doubt was no longer possible. In spite of the dreadful change on the face, Lievin had only to glance at those living eyes raised toward him, to notice the slight movement of the mouth beneath the clammy moustache, in order to understand the dreadful truth that this dead body was his living brother. The glittering eyes glanced severely and reproachfully at the brother who was entering, and this glance immediately established living relations between living people. Lievin at once felt the reproach in the look fixed on him, and a sense of repentance because of his own happiness. When Konstantin took him by the hand, Nikolai smiled. The smile was very faint, hardly perceptible, and in spite of it, the stern expression of the eyes did not change.
"You did not expect to find me like this," he said, speaking with difficulty.
"Yes, no," said Lievin, confusing his words. "How is it you did not let me know sooner, I mean at the time of my marriage? I inquired for you everywhere." He was impelled to speak in order not to remain silent, but did not know what to say, especially as his brother made no reply, but only gazed fixedly at him, evidently trying to fathom the meaning of every word. Lievin told his brother that his wife had come with him. Nikolai seemed pleased at this, but said he was afraid the condition he was in might frighten her. A silence followed. Suddenly Nikolai moved and began to talk. From his expression, Lievin expected him to say something specially significant and important, but Nikolai only talked about his health. He found fault with the doctor and regretted that he could not have a celebrated Moscow doctor, so Lievin understood that he was still hoping. Taking advantage of the first moment of silence, Lievin got up, wishing to free himself, if only for a few minutes, from his painful sensations, and said he would fetch his wife.
All right, and I will have the place cleaned up a bit. It is dirty here. Smells, I should think. Masha. Tanya,
said the invalid with an effort.
And when you've finished, go away,
he added, with a questioning look at his brother. Lievin did not reply. He went out and stopped in the corridor. He had said he would bring his wife, but now, analyzing the impressions he was experiencing, he made up his mind that he would, on the contrary, try to dissuade her from entering the sick room. Why should she too be tortured as I am? He reflected. Well, how is he? Kitty asked with a frightened look.
Oh, it's awful. Awful.
Why did you come? Said Lievin.
Kitty was silent a moment, looking timidly and pitifully at her husband. Then she approached and took hold of his elbow with both hands.
Kostya, take me to him. It will be easier for us to bear it together. Just take me there and then go away, she began. Try and realize that for me to see you and not to see him is much more painful. There I can perhaps be of use to him and you. Please let me,
she entreated, as if her happiness depended on it. He was obliged to yield, and having recovered and quite forgotten Maria Nikolaevna, he returned with Kitty to his brother. Stepping lightly and glancing repeatedly at her husband, showing him a brave face full of sympathy, she entered the sick room and, turning without haste, noiselessly closed the door. With noiseless steps she advanced toward the bedside, went round so that he need not turn his head, and at once grasping his enormous skeleton hand with her fresh young one, pressed it, and with that sympathetic, quiet animation which gives no offence and is natural only to women, she began to talk to him.
It was in Soden we met, but we were not acquainted, she said. You little thought I should one day be your sister.
You would not have known me again?
He asked with a smile that had lit up his face at her entrance.
Oh, yes, I should. What a good thing it is that you did send us word. Not a day passed without Kostya's thinking and being anxious about you.
The sick man's animation did not last long. She had not finished speaking before that stern, reproachful look of jealousy felt by the dying for the living settled on his face.
I'm afraid you are not quite comfortable here, she said, turning away from his penetrating glance and looking round the room.
We shall have to ask the landlord for another room and see that we are nearer to each other, she said to her husband. Chapter 18 Lievin could not look at his brother calmly, and could not be either natural or tranquil in his presence. When he entered the sick room, his eyes and his attention became clouded with his being conscious of it, and he did not see or distinguish the various details of his brother's condition. He smelt the terribly foul air, saw the dirt and disorder, the agonizing posture of the body, and heard the groans. But he felt there was no help for it. It never entered his head to consider all these details and imagine how that body was lying under the blanket, how the emaciated, doubled-up shins, loins, and back were placed, and whether it would not be possible to place them more comfortably, or do something, if not to make him comfortable, at least to make his condition a little more tolerable. A cold shudder crept down his back when he began to think of those details. He was convinced beyond doubt that nothing could be done to prolong that life or to alleviate those sufferings, and the sick man was conscious of his brother's conviction that there was no help for him, and this irritated him. This made Lievin's position still harder. To be in the sick room was torture to Lievin,
but to be absent from it was still worse. He went out continually on all sorts of pretexts, coming back and going out again, incapable of remaining alone.